I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Call it an innovation ecology, an entrepreneurial culture, or just great places for creative people to gather. It's what all cities are trying to encourage to race ahead in the knowledge economy. Our guests today are at the leading edge of thinking about how cities and regions can make it happen. John Seely Brown was, for 10 years, the head of Xerox's world-famous Palo Alto Research Center, and he was the company's chief scientist. A major focus of his research has been in human and community learning, and what he's learned has much to teach cities and regions. Kip Bergstrom is executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. One of his chief responsibilities is to foster an entrepreneurial culture in the state. We'll talk to John Seely Brown and Kip Bergstrom today on Smart City. First, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. John Seely Brown is the former chief scientist for Xerox and was director of its famous Palo Alto Research Center until June 2000, a position he had held for the previous 10 years. His personal research interests include digital culture, ubiquitous computing, design, and organizational and individual learning. A major focus of John's research over the years has been in human and community learning. He was recently awarded the Industrial Research Institute Medal for outstanding accomplishments in technological innovation. Part scientist, part artist, and part philosopher, John is the co-author of The Social Life of Information. John, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City.
My pleasure.
You spent 10 years as director of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and one of the things you learned is that information has a social life. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that in fact, information taken out of context, first of all, is nearly meaningless. It is the context around the information that provides the meaning that enables us to move into action and so on and so forth. Up and beyond that, it is the fact that information takes on additional meaning when we start to converse about it, when we start to tell stories about it. One of the most powerful ways to transmit insights or information, if you wish, throughout a corporation or throughout society at large is to wrap it into a story. Now, the story has feet of its own. It moves around society. But it turns out that in the listening to and then the retelling of the story, that story gains kind of additional impetus. It starts to become recontextualized relative to the setting that the story is heard in or retold in. So stories have this amazing property that basically their meaning often comes from the context of how it gets heard. And so somehow the current context plus the story mold together to construct meaning for the recipients of that story. So stories, for example, are a very simple example of the social life around information.
Mm-hmm. And John, what are the implications for how we learn?
Well, the implications here, I think, are dramatic, because we tend to think of learning as a private enterprise. But to me, the key to learning is how do we socially construct our own understandings of information. So it is often in the study groups that basically what I just learned in the class starts to become internalized and affecting kind of my whole thought patterns and so on. So in a very interesting way, we tend to confuse the social construction of knowledge, which is a very obscure postmodern notion, to the wonderfully simple notion that most of our understandings are socially constructed through interaction with others, through, again, telling, listening to stories and so on. What this really suggests is that we have a very simple constructivist way to reinforce learning. And that constructivist way is that we construct through conversation with others our own understanding. It is the most natural thing in the world to do, but it's the thing that is most overlooked in the way we do schooling. So, for example, what turns out to be a very powerful moment is when you walk out of the classroom and the conversations you have about what the professor just said in terms of the kinds of chit-chat that you have with your fellow participants as you go to have dinner or as you go drinking and so on. So tremendous amount of real learning happens in these informal places, things around the water cooler, things around the coffee pot inside the corporation, things in the bars, if you wish, or athletic fields or just walking through campuses. And so I tend to kind of put much more emphasis on the contexts of learning rather than the context of just receiving information.
Mm-hmm. John, you make the point that both technology-mediated communication and face-to-face communication are important. They're both important. What is the role of each, and how do they reinforce one another?
I like to think of technology-mediated communication having to do with the way that you can extend physical communication into the virtual world. So we tend to create dichotomies between physical communication and what's called virtual communication. But what's really interesting is how the virtual can augment the physical. So, for example, if I've met somebody and have built up a substantial social or work-related relationship with that person, it is much easier to have a phone conversation with that person. It is much easier to have a video conference with that person. And, in fact, it's much easier to have distance learning. So if you look at, for example, Pepperdine University out here on the West Coast, they do a tremendous amount of distance learning. But it's always set up so that, every 2 months or so, all the students in the class meet face-to-face, and they meet with the faculty. And then they go off to their back to their jobs, and they engage in distance learning. And every 2 or 3 months, they come back together again. So you find that the coming back together again reinforces the social relationships, the understandings, the more textured understandings of each other that comes face-to-face. But then they have the advantage of being able to have both synchronous and asynchronous virtual conversations after they leave. So it's a beautiful example of letting the virtual augment what has been established in the physical social worlds, let these two interact with each other.
I know you put a lot of emphasis on face-to-face communication, but talk a little bit about technology-mediated communication without the benefit of face-to-face communication. I mean, it can still be effective, right?
It can still be effective, but it often leads to some substantial miscommunication. Because when you are face-to-face, you pick up all kinds of peripheral cues whether or not you're being understood. So, for example, in this phone conversation, I have a very hard time understanding, am I saying things that you want to hear? Am I saying things that build into the story you'd like to see unfolded and so on and so forth? Because I can't watch your eyebrows. I can't watch your brow. I can't watch your body language and so on. And so we are talking through an impoverished channel, so to speak. That does affect my ability to have a real dialogue with you because we don't know each other well enough for me to be able to read the intonational qualities of your voice and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, we're getting better at having computer-mediated conversations. Bandwidth of phones is getting better. Video conferencing is getting better. We're beginning to understand the types of social protocols required to make video conferences really work. And I think you're going to see a tremendous upswing of the use of video and telephonic conferencing because we're going to begin to understand how to invent the right types of genres, the social work practices and protocols to make these purely a full computer-mediated communication channels work better.
You've said that knowledge flows very easily within what you call communities of practice or face-to-face groups of people who coordinate with each other in the course of their work, but that it's difficult to make knowledge flow across specialties and thereby to innovate. Why is that?
The key to knowledge as opposed to just information is that knowledge is something I'm willing to act on. I believe it enough that it will inform what I do and how I do it. So you have to be able to trust the knowledge, or you have to be able to trust the opinions or the information so much that you're now willing to act on it for it to be called in an interesting way knowledge. Now, when I've worked shoulder to shoulder with somebody over a long period of time, I've learned what this person can do and not do. I've learned the subtleties of when this person could be totally trusted. And we're apt to, over a long period of time, to construct a common point of view, a common set of sensibilities. And it is that common set of sensibilities, the shared practices that we have evolved through time, that enables us to read each other very carefully with very nuanced ways of reading, and therefore the ability to trust each other. We know when to trust each other, when not to, so to speak. So basically, knowledge now flows almost instantaneously inside that community of practice. But it has a very hard time jumping across the boundaries to a brand new community of practice. So, for example, as a researcher in Site Park, I can invent some wonderful new ideas. I can think that these ideas or these new technologies I've just invented are incredibly robust and they ought to be taken to market right away. But then I try to pass them to the engineering division of, for example, Xerox, and the chief engineer says, John, this isn't robust. I say, yes, it is. Yes, really, it is robust. And he says, well, tell me, John, when's the last time you ever delivered a product? When's the last time you've been in a manufacturing site? And so on and so forth. And so suddenly this great idea that flows around the research community here tends to stick and not be able to flow very readily or jump over this gap into the next community of practice, for example, the engineering group.
We're talking with John Seely Brown. He's co-author of The Social Life of Information, published by Harvard Business Press. John, you talk about the ease with which knowledge flows through a community of practice, and yet as the head of PARC for 10 years, you frequently paired people or brought in people to PARC from very different backgrounds to work collaboratively with your scientists. In one research project, you brought in 15-year-olds with your scientists to work on the Office of the Future and the School of the Future. You also teamed artists with scientists. What were the benefits of those collaborations, and how did that affect the information flow or the knowledge flow?
The key here is we are trying to create what might be called an innovation ecology. If you think about ecologies, ecologies work by cross-pollination of ideas. And so the idea of bringing together in one small area, such as our research center out here, many different disciplines, and then have common problems, for example, the school of the future, the workscape of the future, which brings people together around the problem and starts to pull people out of their own particular disciplinary biases or methodologies toward really trying to go to the root of the problem, to solve a problem in a much more fundamental way, turns out a way to be able to have radically new ideas come to the fore and really foster what I think of as sometimes breathtaking innovations, because each discipline has a point of view or is part of the solution. But can we weave these different parts of the solution together into a coherent fabric or tapestry that leads to the ultimate innovation that we want to go after? And so I'm one who believes that to be at the frontier means to explore the white space between classical disciplines and to find ways to bring the best of these disciplines together in sometimes shocking ways.
In attempting to set up what you call an innovation ecology, let me ask you, do you think you learned lessons at PARC that have broader applications to other environments, say, cities?
I absolutely think so. But I think of Silicon Valley itself as a region is so innovative because it functions as an innovation ecology in terms of finding all kinds of ways, again, to cross-pollinate ideas by actually having companies that fail. They become nutrients for new types of firms and so on and so forth. Now, the second thing we learned is the power of the informal, the power of having spaces, great spaces for people to gather, to be able to converse, to be able to focus, and to be able to capture those insights in a very natural way. So although most people look at the formal side of doing science or the formal side of innovation, I tend to put much more emphasis on the social and the informal sides. What happens, again, around the coffee pots? What happens in the doorways? What happens in the bars, so to speak? And I think that the ability to find these social gathering places as a place to mix it up, to bring multiple points of view together, and to create a space for things to be said that wouldn't normally be said in any kind of formal meeting or classroom or conference facilities or conference room is critical in terms of an urban setting or in terms of Silicon Valley itself. And where are the ways that people mix things up? Where are the ways that interesting and accidental cross-pollinations constantly can happen? And I think that sense of being able to cross-pollinate different points of view, which can't be done by formally calling people together, it has to happen serendipitously, it has to happen in a good social setting, I think is critical.
Well, it raises a point, John. If you were in charge, if you're the civic leader, if you're the political leader of a city or a region, do you think you could set out a deliberate strategy to encourage an innovation ecology?
Well, I think absolutely this is something that can be done. I think if you take some of the wonderful ideas of Richard Florida's in terms of the rise of the creative class, you begin to understand what does it take to pull the artist and the creative class together in general. But then you start looking for great places. You look for the places that people want to congregate. You want to look for ways that these serendipitous connections actually happen. You want quiet spaces, but fun spaces to be able to do this. Now, quiet, I don't mean quiet in terms of the usual sense of not having noise, because after all, music clubs turn out to be very important, but rather spaces that it is safe to have a conversation, a risky conversation, where you kind of put forth crazy ideas, or somebody says something, you say, by God, that reminds me of something else. And suddenly you're off and running, each comment kind of scaffolding the next comment until you spiral into something brand new. So I think this whole sense of being willing to take risks, so there are various types of infrastructures that are critical, but I'm more interested up and beyond that in terms of the social fabric that underlies both learning and innovation ecologies.
You've made the statement that we may now be in a position to really leverage the community mind. What could that look like in a city or a region's terms to leverage the community mind?
I think the key to leveraging the community mind has to do with being able to bring multiple points of view together very rapidly in a context that each is willing to listen to the other.
Mm.
So the community mind comes to the fore when we have an ability to listen with a certain amount of humility and to provide the elbow room for somebody to have an idea that's a little bit out of the box and to grant them the freedom to be able to say that and then to be able to build on that yourself. And so suddenly the community mind is such that the whole is radically more than the sum of the parts.
In the knowledge economy, the real formula for success, you say, calls on the need to learn continuously. And to learn continuously, we must learn to see and do things differently, not unlike what you just said. Do you think that a city or region can, again, deliberately set out to develop and encourage a culture where its citizens can see and do things differently?
Simply thinking about what is the role of public art, what is the role of certain types of cultural centers, starts to go down the path to say there's a lot of things that you can actually do. A lot of things one can do is look at the entire system of learning in terms of how do the schools work with the community college, work with the state schools, work with the research universities. How do you have a dialogue constantly going on? How do you have flex happening between these institutions and the corporations making up the region? We tend to think of the fact that, for example, at a research university, ideas flow out of the research university into the surrounding companies. I think that's just completely wrong. I think that basically it's a constant flux going both ways. It is the key of being able to listen both ways. It is the key to have dialogue, serious dialogues always going on. Now you ask, what are the social institutions that are required to encourage those types of dialogues? And I think if you can answer that, or the spaces to do that, then you begin to march down the road of creating a very powerful innovation ecology.
It sounds like you're alluding to a concept you put forward in one presentation I read. It was quite wonderful, Learning, Working, and Playing in the Digital Age. And in that presentation, I thought you made many thoughtful, provocative points, but there was one in particular that I wanted to ask you about, and that was your concept of a regional learning park. And again, it sounds as if you've just alluded to it. Describe the regional learning park that you envisioned.
I think the regional learning park tries to look at various ways to have mentorships happening all over the place. So, you know, how do, for example, experts in industry using the virtual world become lightweight, instantly connectable mentors to kids in schools? One simple example. How do engineers in surrounding companies become adjunct professors? How do graduate students in the various university systems become consultants during the summertime or all the time for the surrounding companies? So how do we kind of mix it up? And again, not looking at things going one way, but looking at the entire set of kind of dialogues that are constantly happening across all spheres of the region. And I think the catch to realize is the way to have a learning park and a way to have lifelong learning. It's not always to think about how do you go back to school, because that often takes too much time. But how do I learn with and from others? How do I even do informal benchmarking so that I hear ideas happening as I sit down to a restaurant and I think, I never would have thought of that, or am I doing that kind of stuff? And so there's a whole sense of being aware or expanding your awareness of what's happening around you and seeing what can I learn from what's happening around me. So you learn by linking, you learn by lurking around, you learn by watching, you learn by listening, and then you learn by actually trying to do something and to lead. And so this sense of like a link, listen, learn, and lead, I think is an incredibly important way to move ahead.
John, if you're advising a community very unlike Silicon Valley, that currently is underpowered in learning resources or low on Richard's creativity index, let's say, where would you advise its leaders to begin the process of building up, of investing in a way that would lead to productive growth in today's economy?
Every region has a set of core competencies. The catch is to look at those core competencies and then understand what new ideas could cross-pollinate with those core competencies. So, for example, I'm not one who believes that everybody should go out and be digital. And don't try to replicate Silicon Valley, but rather to look at what your strengths are and then figure out ways to cross-pollinate some of those strengths and to look at the edge, the peripheral edge of what's happening, and see if there are ways to augment your current core competencies. So let me take a very concrete example. Let's take Chicago, the region of Chicago. Chicago has two or three critical core competencies, you know, industrially speaking core competencies. One of them is plastics. Now, plastics sounds like an old, boring business, but I claim that's far from true, because if you really looked at the edge, you would also find some radical ideas beginning to emerge in how do you build electronics on plastic. Now, I would go back to Chicago and say, what are you doing to take your staid core competency of plastics and then figure out how to augment that on the edge by some of the most radical ideas having to do with completely new ways to use plastics? And so that sense of trying to combine the core with the periphery and finding the right kinds of synergies between the core and the periphery is key.
Mm-hmm. John, thanks very much for being our guest today on Smart City.
Well, thank you. It was a wonderful conversation.
John Seely Brown is the former director of PARC and Xerox's former chief scientist. After a short break, we'll talk to Kip Bergstrom, Executive Director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Kip Bergstrom has served since May 1998 as Executive Director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. It's a 20-member board of business, government, labor, and higher education representatives who give strategic focus to that state's economic development efforts. Kip has a master's in city and regional planning from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where he was the first student to specialize in economic development. Kip, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City.
Thanks for having me.
On Smart City, we often talk to reporters, consultants, academicians about economic development, but you're on the ground in Rhode Island and before that in Stamford, Connecticut, making it happen, actually doing the work. Is the field of economic development changing?
Yes, it's become much more, I would say, holistic, tracking very closely to the work that Richard Florida is doing at CMU. There's a increasing consciousness that economic development is not just about job creation. It's equally, if not more so, about placemaking.
And when you say placemaking, what do you mean?
Well, I think there's an increasing portion of the workforce, Richard calls it the creative class, who are tired of working in an office park by an interstate surrounded by suburban subdivisions. They want more out of their work life and home life than that kind of generic environment. And so they're seeking out authentic places, I would call it, places that have diversity of population, that have a street scene, that have a scale and texture to them. They're actually difficult to create. If you have them, it really behooves you to do everything you can to nurture them and hang on to them. I think we all have sort of Disneyland barometers that we know the difference between the real thing and a contrived facsimile.
What is a good economic development strategy today built on?
I think it's built on place, on quality of place. The value proposition to a business is a function of quality and cost. There's not much mileage in competing on cost. We'd like to be at parity here in Rhode Island with other places on cost, but where we think we can actually achieve advantages on quality. You know, a lot of folks talk about quality of life. It's a cliche, but I think quality of place gets more at what the advantage is. There's a kind of a generic quality to a lot of the development that took place across the country in the last half of the 20th century, and it wasn't that Rhode Island was so smart. It just was not favored as a development site during the period when this pretty awful stuff was being created everywhere. So while we have some of it, it doesn't really extend from horizon to horizon here. We still have vibrant city, town, and village centers that have a quirkiness to them, you know, that a lot of different kinds of people, different incomes, different ethnicities, a fairly heavy proportion of college students and artists and musicians. So I think it's what the creative people that work in a variety of entrepreneurial companies are looking for.
You raise a couple of points I want to follow up on. Let's go back to the value proposition and let's talk about cost. Are incentives for business relocations and expansion still a viable economic development tactic, in your opinion?
Yes.
And you use them in Rhode Island?
Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, you have to price aggressively, but it's not sufficient. You can't compete only on price. I think you also sell yourself short competing that way. So we're very aggressive about our incentives and our pricing. Don't get me wrong on that. But I think the reason we're in the game is not because of being the low-cost place. It's because we're the high-quality place.
Mm-hmm.
We're particularly attractive to folks who have tasted us in the past. Maybe they were born here. Maybe they went to school here. Maybe they did a stint in the Navy here. And it somehow got in their system, and we can take advantage of that.
You know, you bring up this question of forgotten places or places that got bypassed during an era when generic places, if you will, were being built. It's
those are the lucky places.
Yeah, the lucky places were the forgotten places.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a fair amount of that kind of forgotten place in the hinterlands between metros. And the other, you know, sort of dynamic, and I think it's an accelerating dynamic, is that growth is concentrating around the major metros. We're unusual in that the Boston metro has grown to include at least northern Rhode Island. Providence is really a hub of the Boston metro. Yet we have these authentic places because we were bypassed during that period. So we have the best of both worlds.
Do you think that your colleagues in the economic development field, do they agree with you about the importance of quality of place? I mean, is that becoming an accepted wisdom in your field, or is it still new and people are challenging that?
I think it represents the cutting edge. I think there's some form of some kind of a place-making function in most states. A lot of states, for example, have Main Street programs that are an affiliate of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But it's not the organizing principle of economic development very many places. I mean, the possible exception is Maryland. It's a sideshow. It's something that people pay lip service to. There's not a recognition in a lot of places that their primary competitive advantage is quality of place. And frankly, in a lot of places, it's not. I mean, there was so much of this generic development that you can't really say they have an opportunity to compete on place, but some of us do. Rhode Island being one of those places. So what works for Rhode Island as a strategy may not work for a lot of other places. I think you could say that more cities get this than states, and there are few states that could really do what we're trying to do. In effect, we're a city state. We're small enough that our primary city, Providence, really defines the character of the state. And a lot of the cities and towns in Rhode Island are, in effect, satellites to it.
Mm-hmm. How many people live in Rhode Island?
1 million. And then in the greater, the southern part of the Boston metro, of which Providence is a hub, there's 3 million. There's about 7 million in the Boston metro. So that gives you a sense of the scale. In the larger metros, there are 2, 3, 4 hubs that may have the ability to compete on place and compete against the sort of edge city type development in the rest of the metro. You know, states are abstractions in a sense. I mean, cities are actual places. A state is a polity, but it doesn't exist as a place in a real sense. So I think this is going to be driven from the local level up.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. We're talking today with Kip Bergstrom. He's the executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. Kip, in an attempt to provide more than just lip service to this notion of quality of place, you actually put together something late last year called a Convocation on Quality of Place. What was that and what did you learn?
Well, we brought together what I would call the placemakers from around Rhode Island. These are people that are doing neighborhood development. They're land trust folks. They're town planners. They're mayors, state officials, neighborhood people. There's a lot of good work. Historic preservationists. We have a very active historic preservation movement in Rhode Island. So there's a lot of people that have been doing good work individually, but really unaware that there are other folks that are doing things that could be very complementary to them. So part of what we wanted to do was simply reveal what an enormous army of folks there were out there making places and create an opportunity for them to coordinate their efforts and be more effective. And we were also very self-consciously bringing these folks together to speak to the new administration about the importance of quality of place and suggest that this be a driving principle of the state's economic development efforts. And the governor-elect, now governor, came and spoke and embraced the concept, and we are now aggressively trying to implement that as part of the reorganization of the economic development function.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, could you agree on what quality of place is? I mean, and I want you to help me understand how you've been thinking in Rhode Island about quality of place as different than quality of life, because it seems to me in some ways those terms can be used, are used interchangeably, and yet they mean, I think, different things, and it sounds like they mean different things to you.
I would say part of it is the built environment, and part of it is the land, part of it is people. We have this magnificent bay. We have the last unfragmented forest between Boston and Washington. And those resources exist in their pristine state in part because, to a large extent, development has been concentrated in Rhode Island in fairly dense city, town, and village centers. And those places are themselves, you know, richly textured, walkable, with mixes of incomes, mixes of ethnicity, mixes of use, fairly high percentage of bohemians, to use Richard Florida's term. And it's all in a context of a history going back to the original founding of the then colony of Rhode Island and the Providence plantations, based on religious tolerance. And tolerance bred diversity, and diversity spawned innovation. We were the place where the American culture of innovation and entrepreneurship started. I think this notion of vibrant, diverse, tolerant, creative places as being the habitat for innovation, to be the magnet for the entrepreneurial sector of the economy, which is responsible for virtually all the growth in the economy, and the creative workers that drive that growth. That's what we're talking about. It's on a variety of scales, from the neighborhood and village scale to, you know, a nice mid-sized city in the case of Providence. To give you a sense of what we're talking about, when we did the economic strategy for Rhode Island, we called it 10 Ways to Succeed Without Losing Our Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on something now called An Entrepreneur's Guide to Soulful Places in Rhode Island. There's basically three ideas that drive our economic strategy. One, that we're part of the Boston Metro. Two, that we need to rebuild our entrepreneurial sector. We started strong on an entrepreneurial economy in 1790, but we've lost some of it, and we need to get that back. And then the third idea is we have great authentic places that can be magnets for entrepreneurs and the creative people that they employ. So those are the three ideas we're trying to put together as sort of one strategy. It's not clear to me that anyone, the soulful places tend to be the poor places around the world. There's not clear evidence of somebody that succeeded at being prosperous and soulful. If you look around the great cities, they all are starting to look alike. It's hard to see at first because it's quite slick. It's quite elegant, but it's quite generic at the same time. If you look at the Marais, the Latin Quarter, the Upper East Side, Notting Hill, Via Veneto, I don't care, wherever you go, it's the same facades by the same designer. And the great cities are all starting to look alike. And it's designer franchises, but they're franchises nonetheless, and there's a sameness to our prosperity. And how do you avoid that problem? We will succeed economically. Will we do it at the cost of our quirkiness, our funkiness, our individual character? That's another question. That if we succeed at maintaining our unique character while improving our prosperity, we will be one of the first, if not the first place to have done that.
Kip raises a question, I guess. Is it worth striving for? If places...
Well, you know, you can't not strive for it, because place isn't something that sustains itself without the constant renewal of energy that comes from economic development, job creation. That really creates the market for adaptive reuse for historic preservation. So it either goes up or it deteriorates over time. Place disintegrates. So growth can destroy place, but growth also can sustain place. And can you do it in such a way that, you know, you don't repeat the pattern of, say, Soho, which started with artists and then the rents got bid up, and only these kind of high-end uses could go in there, and it forced out the artists. And then when the economy went down, a lot of those high-end uses went out, and now you got a bunch of empty storefronts. Can you plan for more balance so that you avoid that pattern? It's a difficult one.
Of course, the good news is when the artists were forced out of Soho, they went on to, in effect, make other neighborhoods
correct.
Vibrant.
That's right.
So there is some good news.
That's true. And there's a certain cycle to this that you only can and should go so far in trying to manage. But, you know, we're seeing that in Providence. Some of the artists are getting priced out and going to Pawtucket, which surprised a lot of folks that you would start. Nobody would have thought of Pawtucket as an artist colony.
Yeah, it's the Brooklyn. It's the Brooklyn model, right?
Exactly. Can we sustain some sort of balance? That's what we're trying to figure out, I guess.
You said that remaking authentic places is very hard. Your office is in Providence. That's a city that's made a remarkable comeback. How does a revitalized Providence help you with your economic development efforts?
It's interesting, and this is what makes Providence so fascinating to Florida and others, is that we have all the fundamentals in place. We have this incredible physical environment. We've got a huge number of college students. We've got a lot of artists. and we've got diversity of income and race. But we haven't really converted that into economic performance, and we need to do that in order to sustain the other elements. So we're kind of putting the theories to test here. Can being very strong on all these fundamental dimensions of authenticity enable us to convert it to stronger economic performance? And when we do that, can we do that without losing, you know, what makes us
the fundamentals,
attractive in the
right,
first place?
Right.
And that, so that's the balancing act that we're going through right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's, I think the answer is yes, we can, and there's this tremendous potential to make us even a more interesting place while we're also become more prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have to be careful. You know, you have to. The first step is recognizing that you, what is it that you want at the end of the day? I mean, what are you trying to do? And that we want something that is both prosperous and authentic. Part of why it's hard to make new authentic places is that part of what makes places, gives them their unique character, is that they weren't developed by one person, one vision. It was many people over a long period of time. There's a kind of a texture to the architecture, to the uses of the space, that places that are built all at once, no matter how good the designer is, it just doesn't feel real. Maybe one of the solutions is to make sure that there's more than one, in fact, there's many hands involved in the redevelopment. It's not one person's vision.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the importance of the entrepreneurial culture to your work, and that's something that you're trying to revive and sort of capture what has historically been a strength for you. And one of the documents related to the convocation or to the council stated that the basic function of your office will be to foster an entrepreneurial culture in Rhode Island. How do you do that, Kip?
One of our strengths is that we have a large number of research institutions that are idea engines. Like a lot of places, there hasn't been a lot of conversion of those ideas into new ventures. So for the last 5 years, we've been working at doing a better job at helping the universities and the federal research labs that we have here convert their ideas into new ventures and ultimately into jobs. We call that program the Slater Centers. Samuel Slater was the guy who started the Industrial Revolution in America.
Let me ask you, what do economic development decision makers like you go to conferences and argue about?
I guess I wouldn't think about going to conferences with a bunch of other economic development people as a very useful exercise. I don't think that's where the best ideas in our field are. You know, the folks that are making things happen, making great places, it's interesting to me because a lot of them aren't folks that have an official title as either a state or local economic development person. They might be the head of a chamber. They might be the head of a downtown special services district. They might be a business leader who's just passionate about the place that they're working in. It's often not the mayors, it's often not the economic development directors that are the driving force for this stuff. So I guess that would be my first reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I think trying to pull all the pieces together, trying to do well at the kind of technology commercialization function that I was just talking about with the Slater Centers, trying to do the bread and butter job of business recruitment and retention well, because that's often not done well. There's this placemaking function that needs to be integrated with it. And then there's the whole area of workforce development and the connection to the education system. It is the case that you need to do all those things well in order to succeed. You can't just do one or two or three. You have to do all four or five. That's something that I think is just starting to dawn on people, that economic development is much more sophisticated and complicated than anybody thought, and it works only if it's integrated, if it's holistic. Otherwise, as well as you do one piece of it, it's just not as effective because you haven't tied all the pieces together.
Kip, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City, and good luck with your efforts in Rhode Island.
Good talking to you.
Kip Bergstrom is Executive Director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says one way to make our communities more vibrant is to encourage empathy.
It's not all that hard nowadays to find out what's on people's minds. Everywhere you turn, people are sounding off. Talk radio has no trouble attracting people anxious to voice their opinions or bare their souls. Thousands of internet users post personal logs online. They're called bloggers, short for web loggers, and they post their opinions on anything and everything and participate in endless debates with others who also want to hold forth. Poetry slams have become an established form of self-expression open to anyone at every level of artistic talent. Our political tradition of having a vote is now being paralleled by a more therapeutic style of having a say. More than self-rule, we want self-expression. If we are willing to listen, this is a time like never before in which to learn what others are thinking and feeling. And listen we should, for this is the best way to fashion our communities. Politicians and marketers have long known the value of listening. By recognizing the interest of others, by giving voice to their frustrations, and by addressing their needs, politicians win elections and marketers open pocketbooks. They have found that only by adopting the perspective of others can they achieve their own goals. Or to put it another way, they have learned that empathy is the key to individual success. Empathy for someone means standing in his or her shoes and seeing the world from that point of view. It's not about agreeing with it or sharing it or even endorsing it. It's just about being able to appreciate it and then using those insights to help people in ways that really matter to them. Empathy starts with listening, which these days means learning how to listen all over again. Not too long ago, it was easier to empathize with other people, because most of us shared a broader culture that gave us a common basis for visualizing the perspectives of others. Which is not to say that everybody had the same beliefs, only that the various points of view were a part of the overall framework of our shared culture. We prided ourselves on this melting pot, and by and large didn't worry much about the consequences that concerned critics like William White in his book The Organization Man, or David Reisman in The Lonely Crowd. Indeed, the civil rights ambition of integration was about inclusion and equal opportunities to succeed and participate in mainstream society. But this common culture is a thing of the past. Difference is the most common thing in America today. As a matter of fact, difference itself is something new, a style perhaps best characterized as quote-unquote Kablanasian, the term Tiger Woods used when Oprah asked him to describe himself. It's a syllable or two from each of the words Caucasian, Black, American, Indian, and Asian, because all of these are in Tiger's bloodline. Tiger was criticized for not describing himself as African American, but Tiger just had a more contemporary sense of what difference means nowadays. In the last census, 6.8 million people checked more than one box for race, and the Population Research Center estimates that by the end of this century, 37% of African Americans and over 40% of Asian Americans will have mixed ancestry. By 2100, Hispanics of mixed ancestry will be two times those with a single ethnic background. Of course, all of this ethnic mixing sounds like a melting pot. What's different is that it is mixing without the aspiration of assimilation. Today, the greater the mixing, the more unique the identity. Kablanasian, more than Caucasian or Black. Not a blend, but a new flavor. Not convergence, but divergence. And it's not just racial and ethnic diversity. The genres of music and fiction have exploded. Magazines and cable TV thrive by zeroing in on ever more narrow niches. gender identity has become more of a continuum than a binary choice, and household structure is in transition. In 1970, 40% of U.S. households were the traditional American family of two adults living at home with kids under 18. Now, for the first time in U.S. history, it's less than 25%. Unless we hone our listening skills, all that we will hear is a cacophony of competing voices. Empathy is more important than ever as a way of living in harmony because we are surrounded by so many disparate elements. Building a community in the midst of such diversity will require an approach rooted in mutual compassion rather than group norms. People will gel together when there is a shared respect for difference and diversity. And this will come from listening to people as they sound off and then responding in ways that create individual successes, not at the expense of others, but as a byproduct of the successes of all. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter that recaps our discussion and provides all the links you need to our guest. Thanks to Susanna Capilluto at Georgia Public Radio for her production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick engineers and edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.